Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Roberto, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, man. It's been, well, almost a year.
Hasn't been that long. Wow, time flies. Yeah, it's great being back.
I thought it was time blindness, but maybe it might be something else.
It could be. I don't know. The last 4 years are kind of with the pandemic and everything became, it's just a blur of time.
Would you mind reintroducing yourself to everyone out there listening, and then we can get into a lot of what we're probably going to be talking about today?
Sure. My name is Dr. Roberto Olivardi. I'm a clinical psychologist and lecturer in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. I have a private practice in Lexington, Massachusetts, and I specialize in the treatment of ADHD and individuals of all ages, particularly ADHD coupled with other issues, whether it's addiction, eating disorders, depression, bipolar disorder, OCD. Also specialize in OCD and have a specialty, particularly working with boys and men with eating disorders. I have ADHD, and I have ADHD myself, and have 2 kids with ADHD. So I come from this from a personal perspective as well.
I was literally going to say that. I was like, you have ADHD yourself, which is why I trust a lot of your responses a little bit more, because I feel like you have a, I guess, not a different look than most academics who research ADHD, which I appreciate the work that they are doing, but it's different than actually having it yourself and then looking at it and understanding there's certain things that you can't see based on data. There's just certain things that you feel. But I wanted to understand more about ADHD and cannabis. I've heard a couple discussions you've done on it, and I'm interested in how you came even across cannabis and what is your take on cannabis?
Sure. So this is, it's interesting. So I, growing up in the 80s, and when there would be this is your brain on drugs, and it would show the eggs in the frying pan, and talking about marijuana then as being, a gateway drug, is causing brain damage and all of these things. And the truth was that that wasn't sort of the experience that most people that I sort of looked at, even with friends of mine who were using substances and some who did develop problems with other substances. But with cannabis, we didn't really see that. And not that we, I didn't fool myself into thinking that it was good for you specifically, but was it really that bad? Was kind of, that sort of notion. And in my clinical practice, working with a lot of folks who use cannabis, who are dependent on it, and most of them, I would say, have ADHD. And seeing that it was really doing bad things to them in terms of just their overall functioning and brain development. And also recognizing that we're living at a time now where there are multiple factors that are very different than what we saw in the past. The age of onset of cannabis use is much younger than we, it's the youngest than we've ever seen. The potency of cannabis is much higher than we've ever seen. The frequency of usage for the average person is much higher than we've ever seen. So we have factors now that have elevated this substance in a way that we've really never seen before. So in 2020, for an ADHD Attitude, which is an ADHD organization that disseminates a lot of great information about ADHD. I'm on the scientific advisory board. I said, I want to do a webinar on this. And when I do a webinar, I will scour everything in the research. Like I really look at it as, let's be unbiased. And I want to be, is this sort of a fear mongering around cannabis? Is this really something to we really, really have to pay attention to? And honestly, I came at it with kind of like, is there really like, how bad is this really? And I knew from clinical experience, I was like, there's something going on here. And I have to tell you, I was really appalled by, the research and what the research is showing in terms of the real negative, harmful impact to a developing brain. Now, I want to be clear that throughout most of our conversation, I'm going to be talking about data on a developing brain. And a developing brain for someone with ADHD is into their late 20s. For someone without ADHD, it's like their mid 20s. So the truth is, we don't really, there isn't a body of research that looks at people who started smoking cannabis after 30 and followed them for many years. So we really don't know. But what we do have a body of research that shows with longitudinal studies and even, within like months' time, years' time, the impact that cannabis can have on a developing brain, and it's not good. And the thing that is particularly concerning is that you have an industry that is not only marketing and putting a pouring a lot of money in marketing this message that it's not even like a drug, or that it's natural, that it's medicinal. So not only is it that people are downplaying the harm, but they actually are elevating the benefits and thinking, oh, this is actually better for my brain than perhaps medication, like an antidepressant or a stimulant treatment for ADHD. And that's what makes it particularly concerning. And studies are showing that even, you know, that there was the National Institute of Drug Abuse, in surveying high school students, found that up to 7% of seniors in high school use cannabis on a daily basis. And truthfully, we're seeing the impact of that, that it's there are a lot of negative effects.
Can we talk about some of the adverse effects and maybe ones that are in particular to people that have ADHD? I think I mentioned to you off air about kind of like what I would explain to only be like an acid trip. When I would describe getting high, and some people are like, maybe you just, you know, you took something laced with something. And it actually took me a little bit on the internet till I found some stories of people that either had some type of not serious mental illness, but had either bipolar disorder or an actual disorder that really started talking about how their brain was like a sponge. And when it smoked this weed, it was like all those holes, the water just going through it. And it was just really kind of felt like they weren't coming back 100% after they smoked it. And with that little bit of data or that little couple stories I could find, does not really solidify to me comfort of that there's others like me that are experiencing something like this. And it turns out there actually might be a lot of data that's being neglected on people with severe adverse effects, because we have done a 180 with marijuana when it comes to the way that we've thought about it and talked about it in this country.
Absolutely. And the fact that it's, you know, legalized in you know, many states. And so basically, for someone with ADHD, what we have to understand, particularly with that, is that we carry a much higher risk for an addiction to literally anything. And so we are kind of like dopamine addicts. And dopamine is the neurochemical in the brain that's implicated in reward. And what we know about an ADHD brain is that there's either a deficiency or dysregulation of dopamine, where basically at baseline, an ADHD brain is kind of like a bored, understimulated brain. So let's say if we're here with our dopamine levels, and this is the point, you know, where you feel stimulation, a neurotypical, like a non-ADHD brain, their dopamine might be here. So it doesn't take them much to feel a reward. For someone with ADHD, it can take us a lot. So when we find that thing that feels rewarding, man, we want it. You know, we want it all the time. Now, there could be great things about that. Like, I'm a huge lover of music. Like, when I'm at a concert, I am so in my body. I am feeling that bass line in my chest. Like, I am listening to the drums. I feel connected to the thousands of people and strangers that I don't even know, because we have this thing in it's like my church, you know, basically. Like, so it's not, it could be anything, but we know that it could be drugs, alcohol. I work with people who have eating disorders. It could be gambling, it could be porn, it could be video games. So we know that this is a group of people that are already highly predisposed towards addictive behavior. Now, guess what cannabis does? Cannabis activates dopaminergic pathways in the brain. So it really like floods the brain with a lot of dopamine. And people with ADHD in particular are drawn towards cannabis because they'll say, and all of these reports are accurate in the sense that they'll say it helps me sleep, helps me focus, I feel more present, it makes me feel happy, it puts me in a good mood state, it relieves boredom. All of those things are true, and it doesn't mean that it's good for you in that way. And that's the messaging that I'm hoping really gets across. I'm not denying those experiences for people and saying that, oh no, those things aren't happening, because of course those are happening. Like, there's something that's clearly happening. Otherwise someone wouldn't continue to do it. But the danger is that with ADHD, and this is true for any brain, and then I'll talk specifically what's even more dangerous with an ADHD brain, is with cannabis, it's what's not happening that's more to the in the brain as its impact that's more concerning. And what I mean by that is, like, if somebody is taking cocaine pills where they're maybe like hallucinating or having delusions or being really like wild and all that, those symptoms, we call them positive symptoms, which doesn't mean like great symptoms, but the presence of something that we wouldn't normally see. Those are easy to identify to say, oh, well, that's not good. You know, you're hallucinating right now. You're doing this, you're doing that. Negative symptoms in medical terminology are the things that someone should be doing, processes that should be happening that aren't happening. And what we know with cannabis usage, especially to a developing brain, is in the short term, maybe it does help that person with ADHD focus. Maybe it does make them more present. Maybe it enables them to execute certain tasks. What we do know on the long term, it's actually slowing down the communication between neurons of all those executive functions that are already vulnerable in people with ADHD. So studies show it reduces working memory. It reduces inhibition, which means now you have someone who has a more impulsive brain over time. It dysregulates their emotions and their mood, which people with ADHD are already prone towards emotional dysregulation. The ability to break down complex tasks is more impaired. And you see this correlation pretty distinctly. You know, the more cannabis you, and the higher potency, you see these executive function issues. And research with rats have shown that, so in, you know, you imagine a neuron is like a circle, and then that's a nerve cell, and we have all these neurons in our brain, and they all communicate with each other through the dendrites. And dendrites, imagine, are like branches that come off of the neuron. We basically want as many dendrites and as long dendrites as we can, because then it's just like if you're driving from Boston to New York and there's only one route and there's a traffic jam or an accident, you're kind of screwed. You want to have alternatives of different routes so that if there's a detour or something, it's like, oh, I'll just go this other route. That's how our neurons work. We want as many alternative roads. Research with rats who are exposed to cannabis find that there's a significant shrinkage of dendrites and a significant reduction of the number of dendrites. So as opposed to a healthy nerve cell that might have that circle with like five long dendrites, cannabis exposure might have maybe two short dendrites. So now there's just less access and processing of information in the brain. And with an ADHD brain, particularly, is vulnerable to executive functioning issues where processing speed and working memory, that's now even making it that much more vulnerable. But the thing is it's hard for people to be aware of that. And sometimes, particularly people with ADHD, could think, oh, well, that's my ADHD. And they're not. I mean, it's kind of true. Some of that is. But the degradation of that executive function is not their ADHD. It's their cannabis use. But people will mistake it as my ADHD. So I need cannabis to help with this, you know, in doing that. And that's not going to be helpful. Now, the other thing that was a question when I did that webinar some years ago was this whole talk about ADHD and psychosis. I'm sorry, of cannabis use and psychosis. And I thought, okay, now my hypothesis actually going into it was, I don't think that cannabis can cause psychosis. My sense is our people who are prone to psychotic disorders, what we call prodromal symptoms, meaning they haven't fully developed schizophrenia yet, but they're their way, are more find cannabis more appealing. And therefore, you're going to see those psychotic symptoms, but not because of the cannabis, but because they were going to develop this issue in and of itself.
Don't tell me that. I have a cousin who has schizophrenia, so that's scary.
So, however, what studies have shown is now that we do know can be true. So people with prodromal schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, find themselves to drugs to self-medicate. And we've also found, particularly with this question of ADHD and with cannabis use and psychosis, that there are no genetic sort of similarities between the two. And so it turns out not everyone who smokes weed, and even smokes weed a lot, is going to develop psychosis. There are certain genetic variants, though, and to sort of make it simple, there are these genetic variants called MET, variants and VAL, V-A-L variants. And basically, if you have a variant of VAL, that puts you, studies have shown that that genetic variant coupled with cannabis use, which frequent cannabis use, is more prevalent than in the development, the potential development of psychosis. Now, guess what, people with ADHD, we are more likely to have that VAL variant than a non-ADHD person. So now you have a group of people who are vulnerable for all the reasons we talked about, because we can almost feel like it's self-medicating some of those ADHD symptoms, who also are genetically predisposed to interact with that substance in a way that can cause sort of more psychotic symptoms. So when you talked about like the kind of acid trip, you know, or things that people, other cannabis users are like, I don't have that, you know, feeling. And I've seen that clinically, unfortunately, with young people I've worked with who have used very high potency cannabis for and THC products for a long time and really have caused neurological impairment. And I'm not saying this in a fear-mongering way that, oh, you're going to smoke weed once, that's going to happen to your brain. No, it's with, you know, often frequent or high potency, because, and we say or because, you know, there's a difference between being dependent on a substance where you're using it every day. If you don't use it, you have withdrawal effects, and abuse of a substance. And people with ADHD are at higher risk for both dependence and abuse. And abuse is someone, let's say, that might not drink every day. Maybe they drink once a month, but when they drink, they'll have 14 drinks and they black out. That is neurologically harmful. That's just as neurologically, if not, it could be more sometimes than the person who drinks every day. Like, in other words, it's not like, we don't think of abuse as being less serious than dependence, because I work with lots of people who don't identify themselves as addicted to something because they're like, oh, I don't do it every day, I don't have withdrawal effects. And then, but when I ask them, but when you engage in the use of that substance, then they're like, yeah, I kind of go overboard. And then I end up, you know, yeah, having hallucinations, or they end up in the ER. There are like cannabis-induced psychoses that can happen. There's a condition called hyperemesis, where people with certain high THC products start vomiting like violently and just chronically. And ER doctors are noting this, that they're seeing kind of all of this. So that's the thing that we have to be aware of, is that the truth is, and this is true for a lot of things, you could be around people who are smoking, using cannabis, and some of them won't develop a problem with it. I still wouldn't say it's good for them, but they're not going to become dependent on it or even maybe abuse it, you know, from a perspective that's really going to be harmful. But that doesn't mean we're all wired the same. You know, anytime we're talking about any health related thing, we have to always think about who we are as individuals and how that's interacting with the substance.
Where would they be getting this data to be able to look at harmful effects when it comes to ADHD and cannabis? And has there ever been any data to support irreparable damage? I mean, the whole reason the studio was built was because my buddy dosed me with a 50 milligram edible. And I told him I don't do pot anymore. It's just, I never had a good effect with it. And I still haven't, that was 2-3 years ago. And I still feel like I haven't came back 100%. And people could say, oh, that's just being dramatic. But I've said that over and over again to cannabis people on the show. It was just something that changed. I don't know what happened. Not that I'm like, you know, can't function anymore. It's just that there's moments where gaps, I would say. Where it seems like there's, maybe that could be lack of sleep. I don't sleep that much. But there is, I'm just curious if there is certain cases out there where people have experienced some type of loss in their life because of a factor of using cannabis, because that is a real argument that's not being brought up to the discussion, which is the fact that this potency is getting insane and people are having some severe effects. Paranoia data has now come out way over the past 10 years and other types of, you know, outbursts when it comes to mental disorders have started to arise in children because of the fact of people that are using cannabis at a younger ages.
Absolutely. And see, even the notion of that, I think culturally, most people would respond to that by being like, what? No one's ever freaked out. You know, people are calm and like, you know, you think of the notion of cannabis is like people are sort of soothed and like, yeah, man, like the hippies, you know, like, yeah, man, all is good, and not create, like, you don't think of it as something that's activating. But the truth is we are seeing that. I mean, with high THC, that it is basically reducing people's inhibitions. And it's not necessarily like fatiguing them, it's reducing their inhibitions where now they have more unboundaried emotions and more unboundaried impulses in a lot of ways. So we, it's not that cannabis is just making everybody kind of be on the couch, you know, watching anime for, you know, hours and hours, that it can, it's more associated more with externalizing kind of, you know, behaviors. So to answer your question, I mean, there is a lot of research. I mean, through the National Institute of Drug Abuse, there's particularly within the field of ADHD, and basically it can cause irreparable damage. And the way, I mean, honestly, any substance, if you do, can cause irreparable damage, depending on all of these factors, again, of genetic predisposition, sort of pre whatever vulnerabilities might have occurred, you know, beforehand, potency, frequency. But what I always tell my clients is it's important to understand that, let's say if, you know, an average joint in the early 90s had like 3% THC and now could have 20% THC, but a lot of my clients are like dabbing or doing other, you know, edibles that could be 60% THC. That's like the difference between someone, you know, maybe knocking on your head like that and hitting you really hard with like a piece of plywood. You know, you're not going to get a concussion by someone doing this to your head. You can get a concuss, you can get concussed if someone gets a piece of wood and slams it on your head. The neurological impact is much heavier, even though the administration might look the same or almost, you know, be look benign in some way. So anytime we're doing that, we have to be aware that for some people it can be. Now, I can tell you clinically what I've seen are the people that have had sort of irreparable loss are people who have done it. They typically started young, and they did it frequently and with high, you know, high THC. So those are the, but I wouldn't say that those are the only ways that it would cause irreparable damage. I mean, that's the thing, is that anytime we're doing something of harm to our body, we're kind of gambling with it. I mean, in the same way that when I speak to, you know, patients of mine with eating disorders who have bulimia, you know, where they're purging, like self-induced vomiting after meals. Now, we know that there's a cardiac risk for people who engage in purging behavior on a regular basis, that it disturbs electrolytes, which help regulate our heart rate. And so it can put people at risk for heart arrhythmias and cardiac events. Now, at the same time, I worked with someone, because I work with men with eating disorders, a man years ago who had purged a couple times and had a heart attack at 21, because it triggered some predisposition that was just pretty minor. But because purging is, you know, really disturb those electrolytes. So it's not a, this is how many times you have to do it in order for this to happen. We just have to know that anytime we're ingesting a substance like that, it's not, it's just not good, like for the body. Now, I know lots of people, again, who will use it recreationally, and they're like, look, I don't find any reason to stop. I don't, and I just want people to be educated about it. You know, I don't moralize addiction. I am a very strong ally. I have a very addictive personality myself. Like, I just want people to not be under the guise that this is good for them, or this is certainly that it's medicinal.
Can I ask you what are some of the biggest challenges you face speaking about it? Like you mentioned that whole, like, you're not stepping in the way of marijuana, but you're just trying to bring up the rational argument that there's side effects to this. I mean, I spoke to Ben Cort, if you know who he is. He's a big, not anti-cannabis person, but he really brings that up. He's done TED Talks about the dangers of cannabis use. And he just says, he's like, you're a kid and you can get a 1500 milligram cake pop. Like, that's not, it's going to cause something to you. Like, especially if you're eating one, or if you're eating two, sometimes people don't know how to portion themselves when it comes to this because they're just quick little candies you can buy and eat legally. So I'm curious if the medical institutions or anybody that's researching is looking at the data of harmful effects as easily? And then also, when you're speaking about it, I mean, what challenges do you face? Issues with medical institutions because of the amount that they're able to profit off the legalization of it now? I mean, I wouldn't see anybody really trying to look at data that will be an effect of it. I'm sure there's data out there, but, and also the societal impacts. You know, like I said, I have buddies that are cannabis chefs, and I'll talk to them about the adverse effects, and you'll find them getting a little bit kind of a switch flip on them when they're like, "Hey, I'm defending cannabis here. What are you talking about harmful effects?" I'm like, "Well, I'm just bringing up a real argument that really hasn't been brought to the table as much."
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I wondered when I did that talk, 15, I mean, it's astonishing. 15,000 people signed up for that webinar, and I got a ton of feedback from it. Now, most of it was people who were avid users who said, oh my gosh, this was really helpful and informative. And what I hoped to convey just is, you know, you had mentioned at the top of the show, which I always want people to understand, I'm really not coming at this from a like, this is bad. And this is like, I'm someone with ADHD. I'm somebody who, you know, has to really toe the line in a lot of different, you know, things in my life. I just want the real information and the data. And a lot of people were like, wow, this thing that you mentioned, it is true. Like I noticed my ability to focus and pay attention has gotten worse when I'm smoking and whatnot. It inspired a lot of people to achieve sobriety, you know, with cannabis. There were some people who had been sober from cannabis and found the presentation really validating because they're like, you're right. And even, you know, they'll talk about their relationship with cannabis and other their friends or peers might be like, what? You can't get addicted, you know, to cannabis. And it was validating for them to hear you can't get addicted to cannabis. You absolutely can. You can abuse it and you can become dependent on it. Now with that, and I would say that was like 85% of the responses, a lot from parents too, who actually were like, wow, this was enlightening because they were of the belief that weed was like, it's not alcohol. Like alcohol's far worse. So I'll let my kids smoke weed, you know, in the house and whatnot. And it really had them rethink that. And not that alcohol is good. I mean, the data on alcohol, especially now, which is doesn't sit well with our culture, is any amount of alcohol, any amount is inherently toxic to the body and causing damage to our organs. So now, you know, the medical establishment is saying, you know, one to two, more than one to two drinks a week is already like too much. That doesn't sit well with a lot of people. Now, the other 15% I got were some of them saying, basically, I wasn't educated enough. I was not looking at all of the studies. And I looked at studies that, you know, purported to not find negative impact to cannabis. However, I found there were a lot of methodological flaws in those studies. I'm a PhD. As part of my training as a PhD is research, clinical work, and teaching. I'm, you know how to look at a study. There are not great studies out there, and so there are really well done studies. And I talk about the studies that are methodologically strong studies. So some people were sending me, I got people emailing me, oh, you didn't look at this study, and I would read them. And I'm like, this isn't a well done study. Like there isn't even a control group, or there were all these flaws that I could pick out. There were some people who accused me of being part of some establishment of, you know, trying to do like almost like conspiracy, which it's not the case, you know, at all. Some people, you know, thought I was just, you know, calling me a boomer. And so, you know, the bottom line is like, I'm not telling people what to do. I mean, as a parent, I have very strong, you know, feelings about that, but I'm not telling people, you know, what to do. I just want people to know what they're doing. And particularly with the substance like this, we know that there are eighth graders that are using it on a regular basis. Parents need to know this and understand this, so that we don't have a generation of children and adolescents that, you know, we're never going to really connect just to the substance because we're going to say, oh, their executive functions are degraded. Well, we live in this ADD kind of culture, and that may be true. And we may be not looking at some of these things that we need to be looking at. So overwhelmingly very positive, but it's tough. I mean, even some of my patients who have gone to rehab or cannabis dependence said that even amongst other drug using, you know, other addicts in their support groups, sometimes they feel judged because they're like, what? You're here for weed? Really? And meanwhile, it has wreaked havoc on people's lives. And I work with many of those patients who their lives, their families have been ripped apart, you know, by it. There's a wonderful organization or website that I would refer people to called Johnny's Ambassadors. And Johnny's Ambassadors comes from a tragedy of this young man who basically, you know, good student, wonderful son. And he started using cannabis high THC products, really started developing depression, psychosis, and he died by suicide. And his mother, Laura Stack is her name, in honor of him and to really make something of this horrific tragedy. I can't even imagine anything worse than losing your child. Developed this website, Johnny's Ambassadors, and has experts in the medical field and the psychological, psychiatric field talk about the dangers of cannabis, and particularly cannabis psychosis and all of these things that people wouldn't normally see with this. And I would highly recommend people to check out there because they're really good webinars from physicians. Like there was one I just saw recently of an ER physician just talking about the sharp incline of cannabis-related ER visits to the hospital and what they're seeing.
I've came across that website before, but have you ever come across people that have a large amount of regret? You mentioned up to like the kind of the 30-year period, but did you ever talk to anybody who was of mature brain that really talked about the past experiences of using pot? I have family members, everyone smokes. It's just something that they do. But if you ever catch them in like a sober moment or something like that, they really have these regrets about life, especially since they might have done it at like a really young age. And not to throw anybody on the spot, but with like even with friends, they'll be like, I just felt like my life was on freeze and I really never accomplished any of the things that I wanted to accomplish. And I feel like a lot of that was rejected to or put onto pot. You know, it kind of was like once I got out of high school, I really didn't care about much but smoking. And we live in a beach town, so it's surfing. And look, to say that, there's a lot of people that don't accomplish what they thought they were going to accomplish from high school. But there is a large amount of concern when it comes to neglect and inhibitions and what you want to go and achieve in life. And that can be largely blamed onto the pot because it is a stimulant. And when I mean stimulant, I mean whether it brings you down or whether it just keeps you numb or does whatever, it gets your mind off of necessarily some problems. It also can look into some things, but I'm curious if you came across anybody experiencing large amounts of regret.
Oh, all the time. And, you know, what we know with cannabis is that, so in it's an interesting substance because in some ways it's a depressant, that it's sort of, it's, you know, you think again of like slowing people down, chilling people out. But when you talk about it being a stimulant, we also know it reduces inhibitions, which means now things that might kind of be boundaried are more unboundaried. So if somebody, it kind of is like reducing some aspects, but also activating them in some other ways that might be really rewarding, you know, to them. I hear that all the time. I mean, people who talk about, you know, sort of, because with any, even in the field of recovery, you know, you think of it as the moment that somebody starts using substances, people who struggle with addiction, the thought is that your development basically stops. It's an arrested development until the day you become sober. And so if somebody is, and this is for people who are like actively frequently using. So if somebody, and I work with patients who started using at 14 and they didn't get sober until like 25, 26, which is still young, which is good. And what we know is that when you're actively using a substance, you're not growing, you're not developing in the ways, you're not taking in life skills, you're not processing information in the world in the same way. It's numbing that, it's self-medicating that, it's actually maybe escaping you from a lot of those things. And that could be part of why people are using it, you know, in the first place. And so when people become sober, we think that's when their development is. So they, at this particular individual at 25, kind of had the emotional development of like a 14-year-old. And there is a lot of regret that people will have around, you know, if I use that time to work on myself. And again, I never want people to feel shame for using drugs or alcohol. Again, we have to take the moral part and the shame out of the equation. I completely understand why people get addicted to drugs. I completely get it. Like if your brain is being rewarded by something, and as somebody who, you know, again, has a very addictive personality, I totally understand why you would want to just keep doing that. Now, you also think that if somebody's self-medicating a depression, a trauma, you know, something that has happened to them, you know, weed is a very convenient, accessible way because it's legal and, you know, and people have easy accessibility to it. And they're not as negatively socially sanctioned by it in the same way that if someone were doing crack, you'd have a lot of people around you saying, "What are you doing? You're doing crack. Like, you shouldn't be doing crack." But most people don't feel that way, you know, about cannabis. But if you're using it in a self-medicating way, it means you're not dealing with something that needs to be dealt with. You're not, and it's, that thing doesn't go away. It's literally just waiting for you at the door once you become sober. And so, which then makes people not want to be sober, because there's a lot of fear in sobriety, because it means it opens you up. Like, you know, anyone, if you know people in sobriety, will say that first year of sobriety, especially, they feel like they're just a raw nerve. You know, it's just all this stuff kind of, they almost have to build ways of dealing with things that the drug was sort of doing for them. So there's a lot of regret people have around that. And to sort of, you know, and punctuate on a more optimistic level, what I always, you know, say to people is like, you know, we don't want to be steeped in the regret and the shame and thinking, oh, this makes me a bad person. If anything, we have to be self-compassionate and understand, well, why did I do that? Not because you were stupid or crazy, or I don't want people to use it. No, it did something for me. I mean, that's anytime I'm working with a patient who struggles with addiction, you know, it's what is it doing for you? What are the benefits of it? And there are going to be some people will be like, yeah, it calms me down. I didn't think about, you know, being sexually abused as a kid. This would just numb me out. I didn't, you know, I could, all the executive function issues of my ADHD, like it just helped me just focus on one thing instead of being so, having so much noise in my head. Okay. So let's understand that it had benefit. Now, what we want to learn now is that's not the tool that we want you to use. We want you, A, let's come up with other tools and know that that tool doesn't work for you anymore. And that's how I want people to sort of have that dialogue with themselves in a very self-compassionate way. Because regret is helpful only to the point that it has us say, no, I don't want that anymore. I want something better for myself. But I don't want people having that regret spill into the shame where then they're like, oh, like I'm so stupid or I'm worthless or any of that.
How would you go and handle something like this if we were going to talk about legislation or if we were going to talk about education? The DARE program was terrible and honestly probably put more people on drugs than it did steer people away from drugs, just because it wasn't properly educated and you left it kind of most of the time to a cop who just picked the short straw on that one and didn't really know how to properly drug educate. And plus, you can't teach anything in like 20 minutes. Like, they had to go to different classrooms for 20 minutes. It's just not a good example for stuff. But we have seminars and stuff that people can go actively look and find, TED Talks about, you know, stuff like this. But if we were really going to talk about educating the youth, that should probably be the direct audience of this. Instead of the stay off drugs and the this is your brain on drugs, we got to focus on a more positive kind of encouragement where it's like, hey, you're going to come across these things in life and you're going to be an adult that's eventually going to make his own decisions. But we really need to talk about what you're going to be looking at long term compared to what the short term game is.
Absolutely. And you know, as far as policy, that's almost like not my lane to really even, because there are a lot of you know, I know lots of people who feel the same way I do and look at the data and think that cannabis should be legalized and believe that that could lead to less addiction and dependence, you know, in the long run. There's a lot of argument and debate, you know, about that. But in terms of how to speak to people and audiences, I think we have to have these conversations at young ages, because again, you know, studies show that, you know, 2%, the National Institute of Drug Abuse find that anywhere from like 1.3 to 2% of eighth graders are using cannabis on a regular basis. And that's just, and that's daily. I mean, when I say regular basis, it's on a daily basis. So then when we talk about just use at all, so I think in health class, it has to be talked about in the same way that we're talking about it. I mean, I know as a kid, I almost felt insulted in some ways that my intelligence was insulted just to be told that something is bad. And as someone with just, I don't know, my personality and part of having ADHD, I kind of was attracted to things that were a little bit like, I kind of liked, you know, like, ooh, you know, the sort of mischief in me was almost, I found that kind of appealing. But I'm thinking, you know, as a big fan of the show South Park, and I'm thinking of Mr. Mackey, the guidance counselor, who's like, drugs are bad, you know, drugs are bad. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, yeah. You do that good, do that well. That isn't going to work. Like, they're kids. They're not, you know, stuffed animals. Like, they have brains. Like, they give them the data, you know, show them the pictures. Like, when in my presentation, when I talked about that rat study and the dendrites, I showed this is a picture of a healthy rat that is not exposed to cannabis. And it shows these big branches coming out of the dendrites. And this is a rat that's been exposed to cannabis and a relatively short period of time. We're not even talking about over years. And you see these broken, rigid looking dendrites. That to me is worth a thousand words, because then you're showing them something that's really hard for anybody. I mean, especially when we're young, it's very hard to abstract like our health or express, like when I was 14, it was hard for me to even imagine being 20. At that point, like I'm 14, like you're so in the moment in some ways. So, but this is true also of adults, to imagine like what you're doing at 30 could have implications of what you do at 50, how your body's going to be at 50 or 60. And that's with everything. That's with our sleep habits, our eating habits, exercise, all of those things. And it's hard, you know, for all of us to make that concrete. So I think that's how we have to speak to people about it. And we need to join them in saying, I get it. Because the youth, what I hear from the young people I work with is they feel judged by it. And they are, by, I would say culturally, they are judged by it. I find that addicts are judged by the general sort of culture of, oh, like they're either bad or they're weak or they have no willpower. And that's what I have such an inherent problem with. We want to start the conversation by saying, well, one, asking, what is it appeal? What is, tell me, educate me about the appeal for you without judgment. I just want to hear about what the appeal is. And then let me say, you know what? If those do all of those things you talked about, I totally and completely understand why you're using it. So now there is no resistance of like, oh, it's bad. But then it's not the but the and that doesn't mean it's good for you. And there are effects, that there's the short term and the long term. And the short term, it's doing these things that are checking off the boxes and are saying, yes, this feels, you know, really good. This is kind of what it's doing on, you know, the long term. And particularly when I talk to young people about it, to tell them that they are kind of like the guinea pigs, because even though weed has been around for a while, the form of which we're seeing it now is fairly new. So it's not like this is not your grandfather's weed. This is not the weed that they were smoking in the 60s. You know, this is, it's really like a different substance. And so the data we have now is shocking, honestly, even with the number of years that they've been doing that kind of research. We don't know when people, let's say, who are starting young to be smoking cannabis, like What are the risks when they're in their 60s? Are they more predisposed to dementia and Alzheimer's? Like, I don't know. I mean, the jury is out with all of that. And with the young people I work with, they can hear that. I think the most important thing, honestly, that they respond to and why they might be more open to hearing it is they don't feel that I'm judging them for it. And in fact, not only am I not judging them, but I'm like, yeah, that makes complete sense why you would do that. It makes complete sense if it makes you feel good. And that doesn't mean it's good for you.
I like what you're saying about talking to them and just showing them the data. I think we can perceive kids as not knowing much, but I think they soak up a lot. You know, when I was in high school, we had 7 kids die of fentanyl. So I went to school for chemical dependency because of that. So there was a lot of people that friends and stuff like that, but everyone got the gist of don't mess with fentanyl. Don't ever take anything as like a pill that you just aren't unsure of. Everyone has that soaked in their head. It didn't need to be educated, and people, you know, I think a very few still probably ended up doing stuff afterwards about it, but then ended up getting off of it. So it's not impossible with cannabis. I just don't think we've ever had that real introduction into people. I think we had a person fall off of a hotel because they were on acid, which steered a lot of people off of taking acid and stuff like that. But our society has just taken some weird shifts. I mean, salvia was legal at a point, and to me, that drug should have never been legal. That's way worse than pot. But even the talk now about psychedelics being used for medicinal purposes, I mean, have you looked into any data on that? And if there is really some interesting discussions to be had on that?
Yeah, so that's the thing is where, you know, with psychedelics, they're in psychiatric fields, the use of ketamine infusions, there's really interesting research looking at psilocybin. But just to be aware that this is used, though, in very controlled, medically supervised ways, which is very different than how, you know, we see it being used recreationally. So the data is interesting. And I've had patients who were diagnosed and have what's called like a treatment resistant depression who have responded well to ketamine infusions. Some haven't, some it really didn't do anything. And I've had some patients where it's really lifted. It didn't cure the depression, but it really lifted their symptoms in a way that they were able to make themselves avail themselves more to the work that we were doing, you know, in the terms of the psychological therapy piece. So that's the thing. And I think that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up because we do live in a time where you'll hear, oh, you know, people using ketamine, like Special K, like the hallucinogen that, yeah, you know, people were using years ago.
I was in a
K
hole. I'm like, what?
Right. Exactly. And so we do have to parse that out and say, when it's used in this way, it's being medically supervised. There are very strict guidelines and standards. All of these things are being monitored. Like that's very different than when it's being used in this way, you know, when someone's clubbing, just taking, you know, ketamine. Similar with cannabis is that you can't overdose on cannabis. Like no one has died of a cannabis overdose, unless it's laced with something, of course, but if just pure cannabis, which then automatically has people not as fearful of it, you know, and in a way. And I'm not saying one should be fearing that as much as fentanyl, but it, clearly the factor is like, you know, really different because no one's like, oh, this person died of cannabis. All the examples you were using, which are, gosh, those are horrible that you know, experienced that just in your adolescence and knowing people who have died, it almost doesn't have that sort of, it's not as scary in that kind of way. And then when you're driving down, like, you know, I was driving from Rhode Island to Massachusetts, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I must have seen at least 5 billboards for cannabis dispensaries and, you know, green and like organic and like, I mean, just the vocabulary is very targeted, you know, to have people see it as not something that's harmful. Now, again, whether, you know, if people would argue, even people who support all of the things that I'm saying to you, and the research would say this is why we need it legalized, because if people can get it from a dispensary, it's more controlled, it's, you know, they're not overdoing it. And the truth is, there aren't the studies that are sort of being done aren't looking at those individuals who are using it, you know, through those means and whatnot. I wouldn't say that means it's definitely good for you, but we know as a treatment, and I want to be clear with this, that cannabis is not a treatment for anxiety. It's not a treatment for ADHD. The medicinal aspects of cannabis as a treatment, there are studies at looking at certain forms of cancer, certain forms of epilepsy, the wasting syndrome that's associated with AIDS and HIV. Do find with some, you know, I think with glaucoma, there might be studies that do find some medicinal aspects when used in controlled ways, again, with cannabis. But I'll sometimes hear, you know, from clients and even from kids, you know, in doing talks, we're like, oh, well, isn't that like just like another medicine, basically, like for people with PTSD, people with anxiety, people who are the autism spectrum? I'm like, no, like it could, again, calm somebody down. It's not that it doesn't have an impact, but we want to be very clear that that's not the same as a treatment. In the same way that if a baby were crying and you gave it whiskey and it passes out, we could say, yeah, that worked. The baby's no longer crying. But no one, I hope, no one would say, hey, let's give that baby whiskey every time and, you know, problem solved, like as if we're treating colic, you know, or something like in a baby. So that's, I think, part of that education as well, because I, again, completely understand why particularly young people are really confused by it, because there are lots of mixed messages culturally around cannabis.
What about oils and things like wax? I've kind of brought that up to the discussion really when it comes to when you have to heat something till it's cherry red to be able to use it. Is it not similar to like what goes into smoking crack out of a crack pipe? And people always go, that's a large conclusion. I was like, you need a welding torch to get high. I was like, I don't know. To me, that's just, and you could set your house on fire too if you end up putting it down on the wrong surface or something. I have smoked wax, and it wasn't, I mean, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, I'll admit to that, but it was like weed times 20. And I really felt like I was entering way worse than what the other kind of trip experiences I thought I've experienced were like. And I would just recommend that I would ban that illegally. I would just make it not out there because I just don't think that's safe for a child's consumption. Now, maybe that's my own experience, and I have friends that do it, you know, do 5 or 6 of them and love it. But I just feel like that's a really risky gamble because you don't know if you're going to be that person with that effect to it. And you're not going to have a logical brain when you come out of something like that. You could be contemplating life and you could be push you towards suicide, which I hate to say, but a lot of people can't handle certain things. And we're already so sensitive as a society, and ADHD only ramps that up.
100%. And I think what you said is right on. Like if you're heating something up, and with waxing, this is where we are seeing the higher risk of psychosis and suicide and those ER visits of psychotic episodes, where particularly with higher THC, you know, with waxing, you know, dabbing and all of those. And you're absolutely right. It's like, I don't think that analogy is far-fetched with crack. Like you're heating something up and you're making something super, super, super potent. Again, it's when the body is taking that in, the thing that makes it, what has people seek that out means that it's doing something really impactful quickly to the brain. I mean, to me, it's totally understandable to then say, well, there's got to be something about that that's then can't be good for us, or that is placing us at higher risk for something. That's 100% the case, and I, you know, definitely have seen that in my practice. You know, people who use that, and even the first time, second time, like really, it feels like it knocks them over, and something that they almost feel like they have to recover from, you know, that they have to recover from, you know, even weeks after that happens. It's just, again, like thinking about the difference between, you know, somebody hitting you like that and hitting you with a hammer. I think having that education and understanding of what these substances are doing to the brain, and also just not just even in the brain, but to the things that people care about. Like, what is the, sometimes with patients of mine, you know, that might not scare them enough, or they might not think of that, but maybe they value, for example, their, you know, intelligence, or they value their sense of humor. And when they understand that some of these things might be eroding sort of parts of the brain that are responsible for having like a quick witted sense of humor, that could be the thing that they realize, oh, wait a minute, you know? And so in any kind of addiction work, we're always speaking to, of course, the science and what it's doing to the brain, the body, people's lives. But also, I'm working with a specific individual. I want to know what's going to have them be invested in their sobriety. And for some people, you know, it could be the money they spend on, like, that's a factor, like in sobriety. Like, there are people that are like, I'm spending way too much money on this. And that could be the thing that motivates them towards, you know, sobriety. For some people, it's being worried about their health, you know, cardiac things. There are studies that are looking now at heart health and cannabis use. And again, we think, oh, cannabis like would slow down the heart. Short term, it does. But studies will show that up to 3 hours later, it actually is responsible for increasing heart rate. And so for people who, particularly people who might have predispositions towards any cardiovascular event, that it's not uncommon for people who have those predispositions to sometimes have cardiac events within a 3 hour window after smoking cannabis or using cannabis. So that's that piece of data that even when I talk to people, and frankly, I didn't know until I research and did and really scour the research and think, oh, wow, that's interesting. Because you think, oh, it slows down the heart, it chills people out. In the short term, it does, but it predisposes that heart rate to go up later.
If you were going to, you've already said a couple good points on it, but if you would pick a wrapping point for people to remember when it comes to having a discussion like this, or even looking into where you would find data on this, could you maybe give a couple examples for people that would just find a good wrapping point on talking about cannabis, whether it relates to ADHD or whether it relates to just usage in general with the amount of potency and legalization that's happening? Because it's probably going to get a little bit crazy in the next year or so when it comes to the, obviously everyone now is like, how much can you take before you shit yourself? Like, it's just getting out really bad out there. So I'm curious to, you know, what your thoughts would be if you were going to try and send a message to people out there that are really actually concerned.
Yeah, I would say, you know, first and foremost is, you know, it doesn't make you a bad person because you're using a substance, or if you're addicted to a substance, that we want to take that out of the equation, first and foremost. And the reason that's first and foremost is that if people think that they're bad, if there's shame around it, then it stops there. They're not, you know, the idea of investing in sobriety or even investing in learning more about it just gets halted if somebody just, you know, thinks that they're going to be judged or feel less than. Then it's, you know, be educated about it and understand that, especially with something like cannabis, you're going to know, especially young people, most of their peer group are probably using it. And that's true for other things. That doesn't mean, not everyone is going to respond similarly to it. And part of it is us knowing ourselves and being aware and self-aware of what is this substance doing for me, and in what might it be taking away from me in a way that I don't want. Looking at, you know, the research from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, checking out Johnny's Ambassador's website, and to know that, you know, those experts that talk, and that they're not coming from a political leaning. I'm not coming from a political leaning around. I'm coming from, wow, when I learned this data of just educating myself and then wanting to educate other people and understanding that this is a whole kind of new territory that we're embarking on. And just to educate yourself and then kind of just almost some self-reflection of what is this really doing? And is this going to get me to where I want to get to in life? Like, how important is this substance for me? And is it actually maybe getting in the way of some of the things that I want in a valued life that I want for myself?
Well, where can people find your links? And again, I really appreciate the time you gave me to talk again on my show.
Sure. So I don't have any social media. I'm a bit of a social media dinosaur. But if people, you know, if you Google or if you write Roberto Olivardia on YouTube, it'll pop up lots of different webinars that I've done on ADHD. You might see ones I've done on body image and body dysmorphic disorder in men, some on cannabis. I would also recommend the website Attitude. It's attitudemag.com. And they are a wonder. I'm on the scientific advisory board for them, and they're a free website for articles about ADHD, free webinars. And I have a two-part webinar that I did on ADHD and cannabis, where people can actually see the slides and see the pictures of some of the stuff that we talked about, as well as other articles about substance abuse and ADHD, and can hear and see a lot of the articles that I've written there as well.
Well, thank you again for giving me the time. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.